Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, February 26, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Hold on, is it really Thursday? I guess it is. I thought it was Wednesday. So my computer said Thursday. Well, good thing it's Thursday then. One day closer to Friday. It's 12 degrees and overcast here. So again, absolute heat wave. This is just about enough of this garbage. Hope everybody is staying warm. I actually didn't look at anything last night, pay attention to what's going on in the weather, but I think most of the storms across the country are finally gone for a few minutes. I'm sure they will be back. And yes, as soon as I am on air, somebody calls and it will just ring. All right, so I have no idea where we left off yesterday. I think we were reading that Homeland Security Newswire. Yeah, we were looking at how all of a sudden they're now afraid that all of these pathogens that they published scientific studies on how to make them more virulent are now going to come out there and bite them in the ass with quote-unquote terrorists getting their hands on them. And they probably will. I mean, that wasn't a very bright idea to be putting that shit online. Sovereign citizens and anyone who has any anti-government or criticism against the government is definitely a target, but you're not only a target, you are more of a target than ISIS. And lastly was the new Food Unsafety Administration, and that is where Obama is trying to now combine all of the agencies that are supposedly responsible for our food safety into one big, fat, bloated red tape of an agency that probably isn't going to do much of anything. And as a matter of fact, my postulations are it is probably going to work to our detriment. It'll be much easier for them to hide stuff. Please excuse me today. I don't know. I woke up with a pretty horrible... Oh, and there we go. What happened there? I woke up with a pretty horrible headache. And I don't know, the last couple days, it's like I sleep, but I don't sleep. I wake up not feeling rested at all. And my brain is still cloudy. And, you know, it's been a couple days of just cloudy brain, not having difficulty thinking. But, hey, let's get me amped up, get the blood flowing. So I dug into some things last night. We looked at Plum Island and Kansas State University, I think on Monday, maybe, and how everything apparently has been moved there. They had talked about Plum Island being a level 3 bio lab, of course, researching animal diseases. This was on the tails of that first ever seen bourbon virus that appeared in the tick in Kansas. And we drew some conclusions like how interesting that they are moving this level 3 bio lab from Plum Island to the Heartlands right in Kansas, and then this tick disease shows up. So anyway, a couple things I wanted to look at today. I had some big thoughts as I was looking at the news after the show, and I see that now leprosy is on the rise in Florida. I don't know if you saw that. Stay away from the armadillos. And apparently they're saying it's the armadillos that are spreading the leprosy. Bubonic plague. Did I just see too? There was some more plague stories. Now, there's also a plague story out of Africa. I saw two plague stories. One was they are now saying that plague was not passed by rats. Plague was passed by gerbils, if you can even believe that. And maybe if we get some time, we'll read about the rats versus the gerbils. But what caught me even more was the story that came out of Africa about the plague, where now they're blaming plague transmission on cornfields. And that is very interesting to me, considering that one of the big labs that would probably have plague in the United States is now in Kansas. And what do we have in Kansas? Lots and lots of corn. So I don't know. You know what? We'll hop back here too, because it got me on a train of thought. And one of the things I started thinking about was our bioweapons capabilities, and I really wanted to understand kind of where we came in our history. Like I was saying yesterday, we accused Saddam Hussein and many others of having their biological weapons facilities that we never found. Well, check this out. United States Biological Weapons Program. The United States Biological Weapons Program officially began in the spring of 1943, and that was right about the time Plum Island opened. On orders from U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, research continued following World War II as the U.S. built up a large stockpile of biological agents and weapons. Now, this beginning of the sentence surprised me. Over the course of its 27-year history, you mean we only had a biological weapons program for 27 years? I find that hard to believe. The program weaponized and stockpiled the following seven bioagents and pursued research on many more. Number one was anthrax. Number two was tularemia. Number three was brucellosis. Number four was Q fever. Number five was VEE, which is Venezuelan equine encephalitis. How interesting, because I am wondering, I was talking about just recently them releasing genetically modified mosquitoes in Australia a year or two ago to combat the mosquitoes that were infecting all the horses with some sort of horrifying disease. Wonder if it was anything similar to Venezuelan equine encephalitis virus. They also worked with botulism and staphylococcal enterotoxin B. Throughout its history, the U.S. bioweapons program was secret, and it became controversial when it later revealed that the laboratory and field testing, some of the latter using stimulants on non-consenting individuals. And yes, I think actually that is where we started on Monday, were the 13 most horrifying evil experiments the U.S. government has done on the common populace, most of the time without their knowledge. The official policy of the United States was to first deter the use of biological weapons against U.S. forces and secondarily to retaliate if deterrence failed. There exists no evidence, of course not, that the U.S. ever used biological agents against an enemy in the field. In 1969, then President Richard Nixon ended all offensive aspects of the U.S. bioweapons program. In 1975, the U.S. ratified both the 1925 Geneva Protocol and the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, international treaties outlawing biological warfare. Recent U.S. biodefense programs, however, have raised concerns that the U.S. may be pursuing research that is outlawed by the Biological Weapons Convention. And that's what got me thinking. And that's why I dug into this initially, was because if they had outlawed biological weapons production for many years, but we take a look at all that's going on now, right? We have this formerly Plum Island, now Kansas State University, soon to be Manhattan, Kansas Level 4 bio facility that's being built by 2018. You know, if you take a look at how they kind of spin the Plum Island story, it's like, oh, it's to research diseases in animals. And if we take a look at what's going on with these quote unquote outbreaks that we're having, outbreaks with swine flu, outbreaks with bird flu, outbreaks with Ebola, Chikungunya virus. We have had some of the plague. We had, what was recently, measles. You know, all these things, they had to come from somewhere, right? And we had heard back probably 6 months ago about the whole CDC scandal where they weren't doing proper chain of command on all these highly virulent materials that they had just floating around, sitting all over the place. But then we also see that there's all kinds of DARPA money that's being sprinkled at all these universities and research laboratories to come up with vaccinations for all of these, what I'm going to call, orchestrated outbreaks that we've had. And I was thinking, you know, We've been watching this love affair between big pharma, biotechnology, and DARPA progress here over the last few years to the point now where it's not even clear to me if a lot of these companies were initially private companies or if they were front private companies for government research facilities. That one that was working on the Ebola nanotech one, I mean, it. There's no way. They could not have been a private company. And they were all funded. They ran like 11 years with no sales and all the staff, but they were getting funded by DARPA. There's no way that that could have been a private company. That's some sort of government front company that they're running. But I was like, whoa, think about it. Think about this consumeristic society that we have and the way the biopharma, medical, industrial complex has been working over the last, you know, 10 or 20 years here. They're absolutely in bed with each other. And I think our biological program never ended. I think it just slipped into some slippery palms and some other industries that we manipulate and control with the funding dollars. I think, you know, I don't even remember what I was looking at yesterday. There was some website I had up for a story that I was reading, but it was horrifying. Down the whole left side of the page were these ads for, like, you know, cheapest DNA sequencing on the market, you know, three for the price of two, send us, you know, 23 cents a DNA strand. And I was like, what? Are we really to that point where we're doing like mail order DNA synthesis of biological organisms? And I think we are. So this is a scary thought. It's a very scary thought. So anyway, let's read a little bit more about this history because there's some really interesting stuff that comes out here a little bit later. Early history. 1918 to 1941, the United States' first interest in any form of biological warfare came at the close of World War I. The only agent that the U.S. tested, they say, was the toxin ricin, the product of the Castor plant. And yeah, that was like the toxin of choice to take out like secret agents and stuff. You know, they'd stab them with an umbrella. There was a story about that not too long ago, probably a year or two ago. The U.S. conducted tests concerning two methods of ricin dissemination, the first involving adhering the toxin to shrapnel. There you go. This was for the delivery of artillery shell, which was successful. The other, delivering an aerosol cloud of ricin, proved to be less successful. Neither delivery method was perfected before the war in Europe ended. In the early 1920s, suggestions that the U.S. began a biological weapons program were coming from within the Chemical Warfare Service. Chief of the Chemical Warfare Service, Amos Fries, decided that such a program would not be profitable for the U.S. I still got to look into the Shiro Ishii, that torturer from Japan. He was the guy that was performing vivisection on people while they were alive with no anesthetic. We read about him with the 13 most horrifying human experiments in history. Japan's Shiro Ishii began promoting biological weapons during the 1920s and toured biological research facilities worldwide, including the United States. Though Ishii concluded that the U.S. was developing a bioweapons program, he was incorrect. Now, it's funny because this is Wikipedia and I know everybody rolls their eyes, but I still garner, just like I read mainstream news, but I pick out things that are like beep, 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 beep. You know, you just throw away the bullshit and pick out the things that are interesting like this. Though Ishii concluded that the U.S. was developing a bioweapons program, he was incorrect. Beep, 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 beep. I mean, this story goes on and on and on talking about how, no, we weren't doing it. No, we didn't use biological weapons in the Korean War. No, we didn't. And all I say is bullshit, 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 bullshit. Bullshit to all of it. In fact, Ishii concluded that each major power he visited was developing a bioweapons program, and he probably was absolutely correct. As the interwar period continued, the United States did not emphasize biological weapons development or research. But remember, we had fast forward now to World War II, we had people like Monsanto, ones that are now making seeds for our food. And this is kind of where we're going to take this to. While the U.S. was spending very little time on biological weapons research, the future allies and enemies in the upcoming Second World War were researching the potential of biological weapons as early as 1933. World War II, 1941 to 45. Despite the World War I era's interest in ricin as World War II erupted, the United States Army still maintained the position that biological weapons were, for the most part, impractical. Other nations, notably France, Japan, and the UK, thought otherwise and had begun their own biological weapons program. And as late as 1942, the U.S. had no biological weapons capabilities. Again, so they say. Initial interest in the biological weapons by the Chemical Warfare Service began in 1941. And that fall, U.S. Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson requested that the National Academy of Sciences undertake consideration of U.S. biological warfare. Let's see, where do we go from here? Cold War, 46 to 69, immediately following World War II. Production of U.S. biological warfare agents went from factory level, and here we go, to laboratory level. And I think that's where we stayed. And even more interesting things here. Meanwhile, work on the biological weapons delivery systems increased, and by 1950, the principal U.S. bioweapons facility was located at Camp Dietrich in Maryland, under the auspices of Research and Engineering Division of the U.S. Army Chemical Corps. The U.S. also maintained biowarfare facilities where? At Fort Terry, an animal research facility on Plum Island. I didn't know they called that Fort Terry, Terry. That's something for us to do a little research into. From the end of the World War II through the Korean War, the U.S. Army, the Chemical Corps, and the U.S. Air Force all made great strides in their biological warfare programs, especially concerning delivery systems. Now, again, going back to that story that we read on Monday with the 13 most horrifying experiments performed on people. I mean, how many times have they sprayed aerially or injected or contaminated something they gave someone to see what the effects would be? The U.S. biological program expanded significantly during the Korean War, and from 1952 until 1954, the Chemical Corps maintained a biological weapons research and development facility at Fort Terry on Plum Island, New York. So, this was the main biological weapons program. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, it's just an animal disease research facility that's maintained by Department of Homeland Security. And once we sell the facility, we're going to put 500 mansions out there. I mean, come on. The Fort Terry facility focus was on anti-animal biological weapons research and development, and the facility researched more than a dozen potential agents. A facility was also opened in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, Pine Bluff Arsenal, and it was by 1954 producing weapons-grade agents. Another substantive expansion phase was during the Kennedy-Johnson years after McNamara initiated Project 112, and I read a bunch about that over the last couple of days. That's been mentioned quite a few times, is a comprehensive initiative starting in 1961. Despite an increase in testing, the readiness for biological warfare remained limited after this program. A November 10, 1969 report by the Interdepartmental Political Military Group submitted its findings to the Nixon administration that the American biological weapon capability was limited. And the end of the program. Yes, it ended. It was all over. Former President Richard Nixon issued his statement on chemical and biological defense policies and programs on November 25, 1969, in a speech from Fort Detrick. The statement ended, "Unconditionally, all U.S. offensive biological weapons programs." Now,
Like we should have trusted Nixon, right?
That's kind of funny. A little bit of irony there. Nixon noted that biological weapons were unreliable. He said, the United States shall renounce the use of lethal biological agents and weapons and all other methods of biological warfare. The United States will confine its biological research to defensive measures such as immunizations and safety measures. Guys, beep, 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 beep. There you go. Our biological weapons program has moved itself into the laboratory. We've established that. And it has now ended as of 1969, and it will be confined to defensive measures such as immunizations and safety measures. And hey, we have all these immunizations that are government DOD DARPA funded, sprinkled all waiting in the wings. That haven't been tested on humans. Oh my God. Oh my God. We must have an emergency. And wait, there's way more, guys. There's way, way more. In his speech, Nixon called the move unprecedented, and it in fact was the first review of the U.S. biological warfare program since 1954. Despite the lack of review, the biological warfare program had increased in cost and size. And when Nixon ended the program, the budget was $300 million annually. And remember, that was in 1969. So whatever $300 million was equals today, from 1969 dollars, I could just imagine. Nixon's statement confined all biological weapons research to defensive only and ordered the destruction of the existing U.S. biological arsenal. All U.S. biological weapon stocks were destroyed over the next few years, and a $12 million disposal plan was undertaken at Pine Bluff Arsenal, where U.S. anti-personnel biological agents were stored. That's in Arkansas. That plan was completed in May 1972 and included decontamination of the facility at Pine Bluff. Gee, I wonder if they've turned those now into condominiums or something. Considering the plan for Plum Island. And here's some interesting stuff. Other agents, including anti-crop agents, and that's one of the things they were developing, shit that kills crops to go after our enemies, such as Wheatstem Rust, were stored at Beale Air Force Base and Rocky Mountain Arsenal. These anti-crop agents, along with agents in Fort Detrick, used for research purposes, were destroyed in March of 1973. All right, we're going to scroll down a little bit. Agents studied and weaponized. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. When the U.S. biological warfare program ended in 1969, it had developed seven mass-produced battle-ready biological weapons in the forms of agents that cause anthrax, malaria, brucellosis, Q fever, VEE, and botulism. In addition, staphylococcal enterotoxin B was produced as an incapacitating agent. And in addition to the agents that were ready to be used, the U.S. program conducted research into weaponization of more than 20 other agents, including smallpox, EEE and WEE, I'm not sure what those are, AHF, hantavirus, hey, we just saw an outbreak of that in the Southwest, BHF, Lassa fever, glanders, melanosis, plague. Look at that. There's plague. Yellow fever that comes from mosquitoes. Pistacosis, typhus, dengue fever. Hey, dengue fever. That's our buddy. That's why we're releasing these Oxitec mosquitoes. Chick V, which I'm wondering if that isn't the chickamauga virus. Late potato blight, rinderpest, Newcastle disease, bird flu, and the toxin ricin. Besides numerous pathogens that afflict human beings, the U.S. had developed an arsenal of anti-agriculture biological agents. These included rye stem rust spores, wheat stem rust spores, and the causative agent of rice blast. And you know, what really got me thinking about all this is that I saw a big story yesterday about how now climate change. Not only is, you know, California under a massive drought, and we couldn't plant all this stuff, and oh my God, we had all these floods, so the heartland and all those farmlands got wiped out. and sold for pennies on the dollar, and all these farms got sold because the farmers couldn't stay in business. But now apparently there's a big wheat blight going on, and there's going to be a big fat problem because climate change is killing all the wheat. Is it really climate change? That's what I want to know. Or is this all orchestrated? Because remember, we learned that they, the big guys, the rich guys, all play this stuff on the stock market with derivatives. And they play whether things are good or whether things are bad. And if they know that there's going to be a famine, wow, they have all kinds of money to invest against there being good crops that year. Don't think that they don't make money. And it makes us more desperate, and it makes prices go up, and supply and demand makes profit. This, I just couldn't believe when I really started to dig into this. There are way more implications than what I ever thought, and this is just so beyond evil. A U.S. facility at Fort Terry, and this is the Plum Island, focused primarily on anti-animal biological agents. The first agent that was a candidate for development was foot and mouth disease. And remember, a huge outbreak in England a few years ago. Besides foot and mouth, five other top secret biological weapons projects were commissioned on Plum Island. So there you go. Top secret on Plum Island. It wasn't just to protect ourselves. So how can they say that we're not doing any biological weapons research? We absolutely are. And check this out. The other four programs included RVF. I'm not sure what that is. I wish they would say what their acronyms mean. Rind pest, African swine fever, and even 11 other miscellaneous exotic animal diseases. The 11 miscellaneous pathogens were blue tongue virus, bovine influenza, bovine virus diarrhea, foul plague, goat pneumonitis, mycobacteria, N virus, Newcastle disease, sheep pox, Tischinger disease, and vesicular stomatitis. Now, when I'm looking at Obama now giving, what was it? It was some huge dollar value, 1.2 billion perhaps. We could go there. I'll look if we have time at the end, toward combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria. How many of these diseases that we have floating out there now that they're calling superbugs really came from our overuse of antibiotics? Would be my first question. I mean, I always believed that. I always believed that overuse of antibiotics, like they told us, was why all of a sudden these bacteria and viruses, well, viruses don't work with antibiotics, but bacteria were becoming stronger and stronger. But maybe there's shit that got out. Stuff that the genie was let out of the bottle that they were testing on people, populations. That now, whoops, is a problem. And hey, guess what? What's a few people when they come into the healthcare facility? We could document it, and we don't really have anything that we could treat them with, or at least we tell them we don't. And we watch the progression of the disease. Isn't that what they did with all the people that they infected with syphilis? Yeah, they did. Alleged uses. We've been accused in the Korean War as well as in Cuba. Is using biological agents. During the Korean War, the Chinese and the North Koreans insinuated that mysterious outbreaks of the disease in North Korea and China were due to U.S. biological attacks, despite contrary assertions from the International Red Cross and the World Health Organization. Of course, they would back us. Whom the Chinese denounced as Western-based. The Chinese government pursued an investigation with the World Peace Council. And blah, 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 blah. I don't want to read all this. Here we go. A committee led by Joseph Needham gathered evidence for a report that included testimony from eyewitnesses, doctors, and four American Korean War prisoners who did confirm the use of biological weapons by the U.S. The U.S. government denied the accusations, and their denial was generally supported by top scientists in the West. Wow. Things just never change, do they? We've been accused It was proved, we deny, and scientists support the denial. In Eastern Europe, China and North Korea was widely believed that the accusations were true. And in 1988, a book on the Korean War by Western historian Jan Holliday and Bruce Cummings also suggested that the claims may be true. In Cuba, it has been rumored that the U.S. employed biological weapons against the communist island nation of Cuba, and we knew about some of that, too. We had heard the stories about Castro and them developing vaccines loaded with cancer to give a fast-acting cancer to take out Castro. Says Noam Chomsky claimed that evidence exists implicating the U.S. in biological warfare in Cuba, but his evidence has been disputed. Allegations in 1962 held that CIA operatives had contaminated a shipment of sugar while it was in storage in Cuba. Again, in 1962, a Canadian agricultural technician assisting the Cuban government claimed that he was paid $5,000 to infect Cuban turkeys with the deadly Newcastle disease. And then, like I said, there have been a few others. Dr. Mary's Monkey had talked about the vaccine they were making that included the fast-acting cancer to take out Castro. Though the technician later claimed that he had pocketed the money, many Cubans and some Americans believed a clandestinely administered biological weapons agent was responsible for a subsequent outbreak of the disease in Cuban turkeys. In 1971, the first serious outbreak of swine flu in the Western Hemisphere also occurred in Cuba, and Cubans alleged that U.S. covert biological warfare was responsible for this outbreak, which led to the preemptive slaughter of 500,000 pigs. Evidence linking these incidents to biological warfare have not been confirmed, but accusations continued to come out of Havana, charging the U.S. use of bioweapons on the island. The Cuban government blamed the U.S. for also a 1981 outbreak of dengue fever that sickened more than 300,000. Dengue, a vector-borne disease, is usually carried by, what? Yes, mosquitoes. And it killed 158 people that year in Cuba, including 101 children under 15. Tensions between the two countries, coupled with confirmed U.S. research into entomological warfare, that is, with insects, during the 1950s, made these charges seem not implausible to some people. However, dengue fever occurs naturally in the Caribbean basin, and the dengue virus is not considered a weaponizable biological threat or a select agent by international authorities attempting to control bioweapons. But why was that? That was part of our research. Did you hear earlier they said that they had weaponized dengue? One of the things, too, and we're going to go off topic here a little bit for a second, hop back to Africa, in that story that I was reading about the plague yesterday, where they're now saying that they think the cornfields contributed to the plague spread because the fleas live in the cornfields. In that village in Africa that story was about, they had said the plague just showed up like in 1981 there. So I was trying to find a list of some covert African U.S. biolabs, which, of course, searching covert African U.S. biolabs in Google didn't bring me up too much, but I'm sure that got me on the top of a red list, especially as I've been spending the last 24 hours digging deep into bioweapons and big pharma websites. I'm sure, beep, 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 they're probably putting all kinds of, no wonder everything's been acting so freaky here the last few days. Hey, it's my right to know, right? And my right to share it with you. Entomological testing. So this is weaponizing insects. The United States, and this is kind of what got us into this, was the flu, the tick from the Bourbon virus, the GMO mosquitoes that they're going to use now to combat dengue and kill the other ones down in Florida, the mosquitoes and the ticks with Lyme disease. the United States seriously researched the, and I mean, bird, the oh, what's that bird? God, I don't remember. Never mind. That one that the birds get, West Nile. West Nile is from fleas as well. As is the plague is from fleas that attacks then little creatures that then spread it all over the place. The United States seriously researched the potential of entomological warfare during the Cold War. EW for short is a specific type of biological warfare which aims to use insects as a weapon, either directly or through their potential to act as vectors, meaning then it takes it to animals or to people. During the 1950s, the United States conducted a series of field tests using entomological weapons. Operation Big Itch in 1954 was designed to test munitions loaded with uninfected fleas. And in May of 1955, over 300,000 yellow fever mosquitoes were dropped over parts of the U.S. state of Georgia to determine if the airdrop mosquitoes could survive to take meals from humans. The mosquito tests were known as Operation Big Buzz. The U.S. engaged in at least two other entomological weaponized testing programs, Operation Dropkick and Operation Mayday. And a 1981 Army report outlined these tests as well as multiple cost-associated issues that occurred. Operation White Coat involved controlled testing of many serious agents on military personnel consenting to experimentation and who understood the risks involved. And I'm going to call bullshit because I think Operation White Coat continued, except that it's not always with consent. They just give it all to the soldiers now, like we've talked about with the anthrax, untested anthrax vaccination program for the first Gulf War. My dad has said many times when they were down in Antarctica, they gave them all kinds of stuff, and he's sure that they were testing shit on them. And then they sent all those soldiers to Africa to go combat Ebola while the new Ebola vaccinations, experimental, never tested on humans, were coming out. And you better believe they probably gave those to those boys, too, and girls. All right. There's so much stuff here. In civilian venues, medical experiments were conducted on a large scale on civilians who had not consented to participate. Often these experiments took place in urban areas in order to test dispersion methods. Questions were raised about the detrimental health effects after experiments in San Francisco, California, were followed by a spike in hospital visits. However, in 1977, the Center for Disease Control determined, of course they did, that there was no association between their testing of agents on people and the occurrence of pneumonia or influenza. The San Francisco test involved U.S. Navy ships that sprayed Sirata mersens from the bay, and it traveled more than 30 miles. One dispersion test involved laboratory personnel disguised as passengers spraying harmless bacteria in a Washington National Airport. Scientists tested biological pathogens, including Bacilli globulgii, who knows what that is, which were thought to be harmless at places such as subways. Remember I mentioned that yesterday. They did that in New York City last summer, as well as in the UK's tube. A light bulb containing Bacillus globulgii was dropped in the New York City subway system. Oh, how nice. The result was strong enough to affect people prone to illness, also known as subway experiment. Based on circulation measurements, thousands of people would have been killed if it were a dangerous microbe released in the same manner. A jet aircraft released material over, hey guys, Victoria, Texas, that was monitored in the Florida Keys. In February of 2008, the Government Accountability Office released a report titled Chemical and Biological Defense, DOD and the VA need to improve efforts to identify and notify individuals potentially exposed during chemical and biological tests. The report stated that tens of thousands of military personnel and civilians may have been exposed to biological and chemical substances through DOD tests. In 2003, the DOD reported that it identified 5,842 military personnel and only an estimated 350 civilians. Oh, I'm sure that that's just a drop in the bucket, as being potentially exposed during testing, which was known as Project 112. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, scolded the U.S. Department of Defense in their decision in 2003 to stop searching for people affected by the testing. The GAO report also found that the DOD made no effort to inform civilians of exposure, and that the United States Department of Veteran Affairs is failing to use available resources to inform veterans of possible exposure or to determine if they're deceased. Wow, that's no big surprise. After the DOD halted efforts to find those who may have been affected by the tests, veteran health activists and others identified approximately 600 additional individuals who were potentially exposed during Project 112. And some of the individuals identified after the GAO reviewed records stored at Dugway Proving Ground, others were identified by the Institute of Medicine. Many of the newly identified suffer from long-term illnesses that may have been caused by the biological or chemical testing. Both the U.S. bioweapons ban and the Biological Weapons Convention restricted any work of biological warfare to defensive in nature. In reality, this gives member states wide latitude to conduct biological weapons research. Because the Biological Weapons Convention contains no provisions for monitoring of enforcement, the treaty essentially is a gentleman's agreement amongst members, backed by the long prevailing thought that biological warfare should not be used in battle. Yes, and we trust them so much. In recent years, critics have claimed that the U.S. stance on biological warfare and the use of biological agents has differed from historical interpretations. For example, it is said now that the U.S. maintains that Article 1 of the agreement, which explicitly bans bioweapons, does not apply to, quote, non-lethal, unquote, biological agents. Previous interpretation was stated to be in line with the definition laid out in public law. That law defined a biological agent as, quote, any microorganism, virus, infectious substance, or biological product that may be engineered as a result of biotechnology. Ding, 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 ding. Like I've been saying, I think our bioweapons program has gone to Big Pharma. That's why we butt slap. There's way more. So anyway, any microorganism, virus, or infectious substance or biological product that may be engineered as a result of biotechnology, or any naturally occurring or bioengineered component of any such microorganism, virus, or infectious substance or biological product capable of causing death, disease, or other biological malfunction in humans, ding, 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 GMO food, an animal, a plant, ding, 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 any other living organism, ding, 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 a deterioration of food, ding, ding, water, ding, 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 equipment, supplies, or material of any kind. According to the Federation of American Scientists, U.S. work on non-lethal agents exceeds limitations. Yeah. That is an absolute statement of everything they are doing. So now, let's hop over to good old Dr. Tenpenny. She put out an excerpt of her book yesterday, and I knew all about this. I told you guys when I took that FEMA class back in 2006, and they talked about the Blue Angel program, and they didn't call it that at the time. There was a DARPA-funded program to come up with the universal flu vaccine. And it was all under the Department of Homeland Security at the time, which was FEMA. They hadn't quite worked all that out. But they were doing all kinds of research and development to protect us against bioterror attacks. Well, let's link this now all to biopharma and mandatory mass vaccination, which is what is coming. And like I told you, line item budget, because they need people to test it on. Until recently, so this is an excerpt from Dr. Tenpenny's book, You Have All the Risk, Vaccine Manufacturers Have No Liability. And we talked about this. Wait until you hear this shit. Until recently, the concept of mandatory and mass vaccination was thought to be a far-off possibility. Vaccination laws are regulated at a state level, and the federal government seemed to keep a watchful distance away from the subject. That appears to be changing, but the push for mandates is not new. This has been coming for a long time. The groundwork to force everyone to be vaccinated began shortly after 9/11. Former President G.W. Bush, introduced, and I remember we learned all about this, Project BioShield during his State of the Union address in January of 2003. Conveniently so. Project BioShield created a comprehensive joint effort between the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the private pharmaceutical industry to develop drugs and vaccines to be released in the event of a biological or chemical weapon attack. Now, what's even more interesting about this, it's a joint effort between the DHS, Health and Human Services, people. That is when we were reading about Obama yesterday wanting to now bring all of the agencies that are responsible for our food safety under one heading, calling it the Food Safety Administration or something. He wants to stick them all under Health and Human Services as well. But Health and Human Services is a part of Project BioShield that brings together DHS, Health and Human Services, and Big Pharma. Signed into law in July of 2004. The program was funded with $5.6 billion over 10 years. So, hey, they were funded all the way through 2014 when we had an outbreak of what? Ding, 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 Ebola! And the first human trials of untested, mad science gone mad vaccinations. Project BioShield puts forth three major components. One, indefinite funding medical countermeasures, vaccines, drugs, and technologies to be released as soon as, quote-unquote, experts agree that they were, quote-unquote, safe enough. In other words, Project BioShield allows the Secretary of Health and Human Services to purchase and use unapproved and unlicensed vaccines and drugs. But remember, I told you, that only happens when there's a, quote-unquote, emergency. Well, hey, look at this. New authority to the National Institute of Health to speed research and development of drugs and vaccines for bioterrorism threats and authorized fast tracking of drugs and vaccines, a fancy way to use medicines barely researched and tested in the event of a quote unquote emergency. And yes, that was in that documentation. And notice, too, the National Institute of Health is in this as well, and they are spearheading this brain research bullshit. Between July of 2004 and the end of 2006, which is when I took that class, which was also the close of the 109th Congress, 11 bills were introduced. Each of these pieces of legislation would have given unprecedented advantages to the drug industry and would have removed all safeguards preventing dangerous vaccines, drugs, and medical devices from reaching consumers. The reaction against the bills was strong and loud from all political parties, and they stopped all bills except for S-3678, the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act. Frustrated and running out of time, Senate Majority Leader Bill Fritz, a former medical doctor from Tennessee literally bullied a drug company protection bill into law. And God, I remember when this happened. He used his power and Senate rank to get the bill passed during the literal 11th hour at 11:20 p.m. on a Saturday night. And this was long after the House Appropriations Committee members had reached final agreement on a defense bill, had signed off, and for the most part had gone home. Representative Dave Obey from Wisconsin, ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, gave a firsthand accounting of how complete liability protection for manufacturers of vaccines became law. Excerpts of his speech are here included. Quote, Senator Frist marched over to the House side of the Capitol for about 4 hours after the committee had finished at 6 p.m. and were headed home. He insisted that 40 pages of legislation that had never been seen by the conferencees, be attached to the bill, defense appropriation bill. Speaker Dennis Haseret joined Frist's insistence, and without a vote, the legislation was unilaterally and arrogantly inserted into the bill. This was a blatant abuse of power between two of the most powerful men in Congress. And we then discovered that the language provided all sorts of insulation for pharmaceutical companies, not just for drugs developed to deal with avian flu, but for a far broader range of products. The second time that this Congress had subpoenaedly done the bidding of the pharmaceutical industry in the dead of the night, the first time was a vote held open for 3 hours, and I remember this too, while the Republican majority twisted arms to create the complex and ridiculously confusing prescription drug bill that our seniors now so desperately try to understand. A bill that was 1,000 pages long, cost us $400 billion, ushered through this institution by over 600 lobbyists that protected drug companies by preventing the government from even attempting to negotiate lower drug prices. If I thought it would do any good, I would object. But, Mr. Speaker, it has also been made quite clear to me that the majority will not relent on the language that insulates drug companies. That was Frist's speech. Called Division E, Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, with a cute little acronym of PREPA, Senator Frist, a medical doctor, handed the drug companies more immunity than any bill that has ever been passed by Congress. The legislation provides at least sweeping provisions on, one, immunity from all liability. In the event of an outbreak of any kind, all drugs, vaccines, or biological products are completely protected, even if it kills you. The definition is so broad, it includes over-the-counter pills such as Tylenol and Advil. Number two, the Secretary of Health and Human Services has complete authority to declare an emergency. The Secretary of Health and Human Services is an appointed non-medical person who has no accountability to the general public. The president's hand-picked teammate will have the power to mandate vaccines and other medications for the American people. Number three, drug companies have immunity from all accountability. Even if the company's dirty facility created a batch of contaminated vaccines that resulted in the death or injury of thousands of people, the drug company will be immune from liability. And number four, immunity from all lawsuits. A person who suffers any type of loss will be legally prohibited from suing the drug companies. I knew that this was out there. I am just so happy that Dr. Tenpenny published this. I didn't realize that it was some sort of draconian law that George Bush passed, but I remember when this happened. They have no liability whatso-freaking-ever. Through the PREP Act, drug companies have immunity from almost everything, and the bill's language explicitly protects frivolous suits and sets a rigidly high standard for defining negligence. And even if a pharmaceutical company knowingly harms people, the company will be immune from legal prosecution unless the U.S. Attorney General, formerly criminal Attorney General Eric Holder, initiates quote-unquote enforcement action against the drug company in the name of the claimant. This means that the U.S. government would have to go to bat for the plaintiff against the drug company for the lawsuit to move forward. Yes, when hell freezes over. According to the American Trial Lawyers Association, the bill contains language never before seen in any proposal. One member said, quote, "At a time when we see egregious things that are being done by major drug companies, the last thing in the world the consumer needs is immunity for drug companies to act with impunity," unquote. And when we remember that story from last week about the FDA allowing all this fraudulent research to be published, and when fraud has been proven, there's no red action at all. Now we see where all the slippery palms and butt slapping came from. And now we see why we should just line right the fuck up to get our vaccines. Anybody out there who is pointing at an anti-vaxxer calling him a whack job needs to fucking have their head examined. When I read this, I think that's why I woke up with a headache this morning, because this shit is really pissing me off. This is just so underhanded, and I couldn't expect anything less from the government. Nothing. I mean, it's not like we didn't know that this was going on. We did. I just didn't realize how absolutely slippery and connected they were. But the proof is there. In simple terms, the plaintiff can only go forward with a claim if he and she can prove that the drug company performed an... And oh, no! How did that happen? All right, guys, it's Thursday. Make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanche is up next. Mr. Chuck Ocelli at 6. Drew and Chuck at 10 p.m. Eastern. And Antimedia Radio at 11. All right, I guess we're going to have to pick up with this tomorrow. Everyone have an awesome Thursday.